A Conversation with Scott Galloway. I'm Alan Davidson, and this is Soundbites. Following DLD, I met up with Scott. He's famous as a Columbia marketing professor and investor, and he's also an influential podcaster and gives compelling talks around the world. We talked about everything from education to the differences between the U.S. and European tech ecosystems. I started by asking how he'd advise a young person to make the best career choice.
Nobody knows. So I think your job in college and in your 20s is to workshop different things and find things that you're really good at. There is a tax to romance and passion, and that is if you're going to end up in things like sports or fashion or design. Typically, those things are very low paying. So if you're following a quote-unquote passion path, you better be in the top 1% or you're not going to be able to make a living. The backup is the STEM stuff, because that is the stuff that endures. But your job is to find something you could be in the top 10 or maybe top 1% in.
And if they've just got their degree, what's the next smart move?
The first thing they'll do is get to the biggest city in their country, and then they'll work as hard as they can to get to the biggest city in the continent. Two-thirds of economic growth is going to happen in one of 20 super cities. Your context matters almost as much as your own personal performance. And big cities are where the opportunity is in terms of capital, meeting interesting people, meeting friends, meeting mates. The bottom line is the best advice I give to a young person is get certified. That might be a class, a driver's license or a certification around Pilates or a graduate degree. But get some sort of certification such that people will want to hire you looking at your LinkedIn profile. But more than anything, get to a city.
You've been involved in education for a long time. What is the best education opportunity for AI?
In terms of K through 12, it could be a pretty big unlock. I think there's certain schools, especially in lower income neighborhoods, where they don't have the resources they need. And AI might end up being a decent, if clumsy, tutor for kids in home and after school. At the same time, it's a threat to younger people because it can give them the false notion they can have a reasonable facsimile of life on a screen with an algorithm. So as a tutor, outstanding. As a replacement for your relationships, that's the danger. That's the downside.
What about if I already have a job and I want to protect the future of my job?
Get really good at it. Let's fire the guy or the gal that understands AI, said no one ever. So be the person that understands how AI can help you and your department be more efficient. This is an opportunity to stand out. AI is not going to take your job. Someone who understands AI is going to take your job. So the vaccine against AI is understanding it.
I know you've been concerned about social media. What's the best way to fix it?
Big tech is not our friend. It's not concerned with the well-being of our children. Their job is every day to figure out how to get our kids spending one more minute away from relationships and on a screen, which they can monetize. So there's a real threat that the deepest pocketed, most talented companies in the world are trying to separate us and isolate us. And young people, especially young men, are especially vulnerable to the notion they can have friends, income, romantic partners on a screen. Men ages 20 to 30 are spending less time outdoors than prison inmates. The number of teens who see their friends every day has been cut in half.
That's pretty scary.
Keep in mind, a million times a second, these companies are figuring out algorithms that will keep you glued to your phone, whether it's another cute cat video, something titillating, a piece of content that upsets you. So you're up against almost an indomitable foe. If you type into ChatGPT or Claude, if you were the devil, what would you do to ruin youth? Both will come back with something that looks, smells, and feels like social media. So I think this is the existential threat of our time, and that is I worry we're evolving a new species of asocial, asexual males who no longer feel a need to develop the skills to get along with other people, find jobs, find romantic partners, find mentors, find friends, and they wake up in their 20s and their 30s and find themselves depressed, anxious, and obese. So I think loneliness is the true externality of AI. I don't think it's self-healing weapons or Terminator or Skynet or even income inequality, which is something we've all decided we're comfortable with, at least in terms of who we vote for. The real threat of AI is sequestering people from their most important, the most important thing, and that is relationships. That's the real fear.
So what's the best way to fight it? And what about the parents?
Unfortunately, there is a profit incentive in destroying childhood, and that is taking them away from free play, from being outdoors, from being from their friends. So I think parents have to be very mindful and very disciplined around getting their kids out of the house and ensuring that they bump off of other people and spend less time on a screen, which, by the way, is an enormous challenge.
And we know that all these systems capture a lot of information about us. Should we be concerned?
So everyone has the right to have secrets, and there's a fear that your most intimate, private information at some point will be gathered and weaponized against you by bad actors or even your government. So privacy and the fact that every move, every purchase, every thought is now being recorded on a server makes privacy especially important. The issue is that there's some consumer dissonance. What do I mean by that? The difference between what people say and how they act, and that is every day, young people will nod their head about the importance of privacy, and then at the next moment, they will hold up their phone and tell everyone, including strangers, where they are, what they're doing, and who they're doing it with. So the reality is a younger generation has essentially decided to give up all privacy in exchange for utility. A thin layer of AI on Uber, if Uber was hacked, could tell us if you've terminated a pregnancy, your HIV status, if you're having affairs, you could basically reveal to the world a lot of things you probably wouldn't be comfortable with. But so far, we haven't seen a lot of movement or support for real privacy regulation. So while privacy gets a lot of oxygen, consumers so far seem to be comfortable risking their privacy.
Are they right to be comfortable?
We've had institutions in place that have respected our privacy. So, for example, the government knows your HIV status, but they've been very careful to ensure that there's protections through HIPAA and privacy regulation. I think we take for granted our institutions that respect our privacy. So I think our memory is somewhat short about how data can be used against us.
Let's change track for a minute. What's your impression of Europe's tech ecosystem, and how can we reinforce the partnership between the U.S. and Europe?
Well, there's some really powerful strengths. You have incredible education institutions. You have multiculturalism. So theoretically, a lot of the great CPG companies were able to expand faster, Nestle or L'Oreal, because they understand the importance of tailoring a product for a different culture. You have a lot of innovation. So there's all the underpinnings of what should be an incredibly strong tech sector and entrepreneurial sector here. What's missing is what I call the risk gene. And that is when I speak to audiences here in the UK and they ask, what's the difference between the UK and the US? I say, you're the ones that stayed. So my parents got on a steamship at the age of 19 to come to America. So risk is directly correlated to innovation. And there's just a much greater propensity to take crazy risks in the US.
So why do you think it's easier to raise money in the States than it is in Europe?
There isn't nearly the capital formation here. There's $5 million of investment capital for every startup in the U.S. There's only 1 million in Europe. And there's five times as many entrepreneurs per capita in the U.S. as in the EU. So there's a lot of the underpinnings of what should be a great entrepreneurial technology sector, but it's missing the risk gene and it's missing capital. If you're in Germany, there's a downside to the social safety net. The safety net in the U.S. is a concrete floor. At the same time, the tax rates are very low for billionaires. So everything has asymmetric upside to taking risks. Whereas if you live in Germany, if you do a couple classes in auto shop in high school, you can come out of a German high school making 70 or 80,000 euros working for an automobile company or manufacturer. And then you can have a decent life, go to a beer garden on the weekend that also has trampolines. So the temptation to take risks is great. In Germany, the social safety net is higher and the upside is somewhat capped. So in the U.S., we purposely have decided to create an ecosystem that rewards upside, rewards risk. So there's just less of a temptation here to take the kind of risks that people are comfortable with their human capital and with their financial capital. And the result is there's almost no important tech companies in Europe. You have one company, NVIDIA, is worth more than every publicly traded company in Germany and in Spain. Combined. So 70% of the companies that have gone public in the UK in the last 10 years are below their offering price. And if you don't have capital formation, essentially what happens is all the most talented people who see an opportunity for a huge upside but need capital to scale, they end up going to the US.
DeepMind was a good example of that, wasn't it?
DeepMind was arguably one of the most important AI companies. They sold to a US company, Alphabet, to help them scale. That arguably could have been a 10, 20, 30. Look at Anthropic. Anthropic was started 6 years ago. If it was in Europe, it'd be one of the 10 most valuable companies. The U.S. is starting those every other year.
And what do you think is the solution?
That's the correct question. I think there's going to have to be more coordination between governments, less regulation, more government tax policies that attract more capital. But at the end of the day, what inspires a tech ecosystem is two kids in a dorm at the University of Texas who build a company assembling computers. They make billions of dollars and they stay in Austin and start VCs and create an ecosystem. The governments of Europe need to be focused on figuring out the infrastructure and capital such that they have some thoroughbreds and some multi-billion dollar outcomes that create an ecosystem. So it's a combination of tax policy, foreign investment, and also probably a real attempt to cut regulation to make it easy for a tech startup to open an office in Madrid. You know, supposedly in France, if you fire someone, it costs you 18 months of salary. In the US, it's 3 to 4 months. So the reality is the easier it is to fire someone, the easier it is to hire someone. And there's a lot of countries in Europe that have made it very difficult to hire people because they've made it very difficult to fire people. So it's a reduction in regulation, but more than anything, I think it's trying to figure out economic and tax policies that create more capital formation for young companies.
But you still see opportunities in Europe. Why?
The view is that Europe is the fallen empire, which probably means it's a decent investment opportunity because the moment an asset class, if you think of the EU as an asset class, the moment it's been left for dead, that's usually the time you should invest and make money, right? When everyone thought there was no way you'd be able to sell a condo in Florida in 2009, that was the time to invest. So I would argue there's probably a decent amount of upside in European companies right now. And the European economy, it's not as big as the U.S., but it rivals the U.S. on the whole. You know, this is a kind of a, you know, it's a federation. The bottom line is Europe isn't much of a union. There are 27 different people who all have veto power, as opposed to in the U.S., state governments are there mostly for taxation and social services, not to dictate economic policy. The upside of Trump's policy is basically withdrawing from this kind of world order is that the EU recognizes it's kind of on its own, and that may result in actually more growth because the lack now of the European or the U.S. military defense umbrella, there's oftentimes a lot of spillover, technology spillover from military spending or defense spending. GPS came from defense spending. The internet came from an attempt to build a post-apocalyptic communications network. So if the EU goes from 1% of GDP to 3% of defense, that actually might jumpstart some of the technology infrastructure. I think Ukraine, when the war comes to an end, could arguably be one of the fastest growing economies in the world because the war there has inspired just an incredible innovation around technology that will have all sorts of commercial applications.
Do you see that as pushing AI towards open source more?
Open source helps you scale faster, but it's harder to ring fence the IP such that you can capture economic value. So to a certain extent, I think AI, by virtue of the fact that these LLMs can crawl other LLMs, to a certain extent, they're open source. If you asked a DeepSeek, the Chinese LLM model, in its first 2 weeks when it hit the market, who are you? It said that I'm OpenAI. So what kind of I find sort of delicious irony is that the first person to lose their job from AI might be AI itself. And that is technically all the models are converging. So open source lets you scale faster, but again, it's harder to ring fence the IP and capture shareholder value. And I wonder if AI is going to be more like vaccines or jet transportation technology, where the real winners are the populace, but no small set of companies is able to ring fence it and capture tons of shareholder value. So I find it actually quite encouraging. I believe there's going to be few AI companies that are able to hold on to their trillions of dollars in market cap because AI will just reverse engineer their technology. But I'm happy that I think the big winners will be all of us. I think it's going to increase productivity. Actually, I'm not an AI catastrophist. I think it's going to have a lot of positive unlocks, especially around healthcare.
One of Europe's leading AI champions is Mistral. Do you see opportunity for it?
Yeah, I think so. That's an amazing company, but the winner there, it's very European. The winner there will be the public, but it's unlikely it's ever going to have the market capitalization of American companies that are more focused on changing, you know, the shape of the charger so they can capture tons of revenue, and immediately they start filing for all sorts of patents. So, yeah, I'm hopeful. I hope it does well. But American companies, kind of the first thing they think when they wake up in the morning and they go to sleep at night is, how do I create shareholder value? And I think most European entrepreneurs wake up and think, how can I be influential, or how can I get prestige and relevance in our society? I think Americans feel that the correlation between money and happiness and relevance is one. So almost everything Americans do is focused on, quite frankly, we have an idolatry of the dollar, and Europeans still, for better or for worse, worship at different altars.
One thing's for sure. If we all work together, we all come out stronger. Thank you for joining me. I'm Alan Davidson with Soundbites.